Welcome, everybody. Good to see you again. This is always a strategy I wanted. When people sit halfway to the back of the church, we move towards you. Easier than forcing you to come forwards. So in a moment, we'll just have, as it has been our habit, a few moments of quiet to collect ourselves. But if I might just introduce Wyan, who I've only known reasonably recently, actually, in the last this year. This is Wyan, smiling at you. first time I met Wyan was when I was taking sleeping bags and all sorts of equipment that this community had thrown at me in response to the call for equipment to take down to Calais to support migrants and refugees who are stuck in the Calais camps there. And I took them down to the Emmaus buildings, and there was Wyan packing a van to drive down there, which is great, just a sort of brief sighting of you. Then I became aware that also he's running this thing called Sanctuary Hosting. Can't remember how I've probably got an email about that. I hope he'll tell us about that. Really, really interesting and important project in Oxford, supporting homeless migrants in a very key way. And then, you know, round about the time that I was so excited about having written a book, and completely forgetting that other people also write books, Wyan mentioned, I've written a book as well. And so I bought his book quickly. And this book, which I hope he'll also tell us about. But Wyan, for all those reasons and all those ways I've mentioned him, is a man of compassion who not only acts it out, but thinks and struggles with how can we become more compassionate, which is a very, very profound and important question in our day. So it's been my joy to get to know Wyan over recent months, year or so, and really, really pleased to have him here to speak tonight. And speaking again from a different angle, we've said this is a series of alternatives. Is there another way of thinking about things? And of course, as Christians, it's very helpful to understand how people who are not within the Christian tradition think about things. We will have so much to learn. And Wyan sits in that sort of territory. So thank you, Wyan. It's really, really good to have you here. And we're looking forward to... there are many, many things you could talk about. So looking forward to what you've chosen of the many things to share with us. But shall we take a few moments to be quiet then, just to allow all that is buzzing around, that is perhaps still with us from the day, or even what we were involved in just a few moments ago, to settle just a bit, so that we might be here. So, thank you. We'll follow the same pattern as last week then. Wyan will speak for a period of time. Then there'll be a chance to just to chat to our neighbour, bring up the sort of things that have struck us, and then we'll have a session of comments, questions, discussion. So, would you welcome Wyan?
Thank you so much, Tim, for that kind introduction. And I was just remembering the first time that I remember meeting Tim, which was actually before the time you flagged up. I remember coming one time and you were playing the guitar in here and the congregation was singing along. And I thought then, what a kind, calm man this is. And how nice he is to be around. And I thought then, I wouldn't mind a bit more of that. And certainly that's been my experience over the last few months. It's been a great joy to get to know you a bit more and just to be around you. And so, you know, maybe you should be the one giving this talk on compassion. Because, you know, when I thought about... When Tim asked me to give a talk on compassion, my immediate reaction was... Yes, I want to do that. I had absolutely no doubt about it. What could be more important than thinking about compassion And then not long after that, the doubts started to kick in. And I thought, who am I? Who am I to talk about compassion? You know, when I look within, I'm far from a saint and I'm far from a guru. I see inside myself anger, irritation, despair, envy, jealousy. You know, all the things that we all probably suffer from. I'm just an ordinary person. And so in that sense, it seemed to me that, you know, perhaps I shouldn't, I'm not the one. I shouldn't be doing this. But then two things brought me around to doing it, because actually I wanted to do it. And one of them was a reflection around our ordinariness and the need to speak anyway. And I brought along a little prop, which I think illustrates this. Can you all see this? Rather naive-looking giraffe on a plate. And I kind of identify with this giraffe, right? The giraffe is sticking its neck out, naively as I say, in order to talk about compassion. And do you know, this is somehow this has gone out of currency, talking about compassion. I was born in the 50s, and I was lucky enough to experience the 60s at a formative stage of my life. And during that time, it was okay. It was okay to talk about love and peace, and it was okay to be idealistic. In fact, that was the fashion. I thought it was a really exciting time to grow up in, and the world was full of hope for our species. And I'm sure I don't need to remind you that, you know, things aren't quite the same now. And, you know, we live in a distracted age, and an age which can quite often be cynical. And people who do talk about things like love and compassion and so on quite often get ridiculed. And so it's kind of gone out of parlance, perhaps not so much in this congregation, but I'm talking about out there. And I think that's a pity. But if we wait around for gurus and saints to do it, we may wait a long time. And in a way, I think the moral obligation comes on all of us to talk about it, but also to talk about it from the perspective of our woundedness. You know, there's always a gap between how we would like to be and how we are. And that's something that we need to engage with if we're to become more compassionate. You may not have noticed, but this plate has a diagonal crack across it. It's actually a broken plate. It's broken twice, and twice we've glued it up. And it's still functional. We can serve little cakes on it at tea time. So this plate, although it's broken, is able to be of service, and I believe that we're likewise able to be of service. So that's one reason why I thought that, why I legitimized myself for giving this talk on compassion. The other reason Tim has already flagged up, which is that I'm involved with this wonderful organization called Sanctuary Hosting, which started 3 years ago. The organization, to put it simply, matches homeless refugees and asylum seekers with people who've got a spare room in their house, who are willing to have someone living with them for free for a finite period. And over the 3 years or so that we've been running, we've housed people for 10,000 nights and approved 60 sets of hosts. So it's an extraordinary scheme, and it's very community-based, but the thing that's been extraordinary for me, and such a privilege for me, has been to meet the hosts, who are these remarkable, compassionate people who are willing to let, you know, sometimes complete strangers or relative strangers live with them in their house. And they've taught me one or two things about compassion. So that's the other thing that made me think that perhaps I can talk about this really important subject. So what I'm going to do is I've divided it into three sections, this talk. The first section is addressing what is compassion and what isn't compassion. The second section is, well, why should we be compassionate? Let's ask the question before we do anything. It's important to know what our purpose is. And the third thing I'm going to talk about is how to be compassionate and what stops us from being compassionate. Okay, so let's start with what is compassion. And I think the easiest way for me to look at this is to look at what isn't compassion. So I think it's helpful to use the word compassion rather than love. And the reason, although there's a lot of overlap of love and compassion, I think there are some important differences. People use the words interchangeably. But I prefer compassion because I think the word love has got slightly lopsided in our culture because of romantic love. And if you listen to Radio 1, you'll know what I mean. You know, if you listen to the songs, they're all about, if you leave me, I won't want to live anymore. You're the gap that filled my life. I can't bear it now that you've left. You're everything to me. You've made me complete, and all of this. And in my perception, this is not really compassion. This is about the need of the person who feels that they're in love and feels that somehow someone else can fix them. So it's not about the person being in love actually being loving towards the person they're in love with, although the lovely feelings that come up when we're in love may make us more predisposed to be loving. It's far more about the person's inner needs and their inner dependencies and the issues that aren't resolved in their life. So for that reason, I think it's helpful to think in terms of compassion rather than love. And the other thing that I want to say to separate out from compassion is empathy, which is a subtler distinction. But I think it's, as we'll see, I think there's great insight to be derived from separating the two out a bit. So I would define empathy as being about seeing something from someone else's point of view, walking in their moccasins, understanding their thoughts and feelings. And incidentally, that's what my book's about. Toggle is about empathy. It's a fiction book, and it poses the question, if you were able to really do that, really know what someone else thinks and feels. And even if there was a wonderful altruistic machine that somehow matched you with the person you could learn the most from, how would that be? How would it change you? And also, would you opt to do it? And what would governments think of a machine that was made available like that? And how might it affect our species? So anyhow, that's what the book's about, and it's a fiction. So that's empathy. And how I would define compassion is that it's empathy plus action. Okay? So compassion is the thing that moves us from empathy into a mode where we really want to help, we really want to do something, we want to proactively relieve the person we can understand is suffering. We want to somehow help that person. We want to relieve them from their suffering. So I'm defining compassion as empathy plus action. Okay. So that's a little bit about what is compassion. The next question is, so why? Why should we be compassionate? And I have two answers to this question. Of The first answer is that I think it's the best possibility for us in terms of our species surviving. That if we can develop compassion, we are less likely to wipe ourselves out. It's a sad reality, this, but I think it has truth in it. So the way I see it, as our compassion grows, the circle of identity that we're prepared to be more compassionate with, prepared to be compassionate with, also expands. So if you think of the most selfish person, they're just after themselves and they don't care about anyone else. Most people aren't like that, but some are. And then the next step up is that we're concerned about our immediate family. And most parents that I know would willingly give their lives for their children. So that's an example of compassion having spread a little way to the local family. And then the next step is the extended family and so on. And we can keep growing. But it seems to me that most people, and research also supports this, most people are stuck at what we can call ethnocentric. So about 70% of people their compassion only extends to what we're going to call ethnocentric, okay, or less. So ethnocentric is where we identify with a group that's larger than our extended family, but much smaller than the species. So we're talking here, we identify with our race, our religion, our country, our skin colour. That's the type of group we're pitching at. It's quite a big, it could be a football club as well. It's quite a big group, but it's not the whole species. Now, if the limit of our compassion is this group, then in my perception, that's extremely dangerous. Because what you have is a recipe for war, basically. And what we've got going on in America is we have somebody who is ethnocentric to America. Actually, he may be ethnocentric to his family and posing as ethnocentric to America, but let's not knock the man, I don't know. But anyhow, he's clearly not compassionate towards the whole species. And we have someone in North Korea who has a similar orientation. And we have a very difficult combination there, where they may put the benefit and welfare of the immediate group around them before the whole species. So that's one reason why I think it's really critical that we develop our compassion, so that it doesn't just cover our group, but it goes beyond that, at least to our species. And there may be more beyond that. But let's just keep it to the species for the moment. So that's the first reason why I think it's important for us to develop compassion. The second reason is more personal to all of us, really, I guess. I started life as an atheist, and then I became an agnostic. And then last year, about a year ago, I got diagnosed with cancer. I've got prostate cancer, which is possibly going to be okay, I'm not sure yet. But anyhow, when I first got the diagnosis, I didn't know whether the cancer had run rife in my body or not. And so, as you can imagine, it was a very challenging time. And I started to ask some big questions of myself. You know, what's my life about? What do I want to be doing? I don't know how long I'm going to live for. And suddenly, each day became far more important than it had been. You know, I think a lot of us certainly... I'm talking about myself here, certainly myself, most of my time, I'm distracted, I'm not focused, I'm certainly not in the present, and I'm living life as though it goes on forever. And having this possible terminal diagnosis woke me up to the fact that this is not a dress rehearsal, you know. We only have the days we've got and none of us know how long they are. So what are we going to do with this precious time that we have? How are we going to use it? And when I asked that question, there was something self-evident for me that the only reason to come back into the present moment was to be kind and to be loving and to learn how to do that. Now, I don't know where that came from, but I do know it with a conviction inside myself. And I suspect that many people also know that with a conviction inside themselves if they really allow themselves to think how they most want to use their lives. Do you want to have a life that's wasted, that's filled up with addictions, that is somehow suboptimal? Or do you somehow want to live your life as beautifully as you possibly can? For me, the answer to that is self-evident. And I think people have different ways of articulating how they know that. Certainly when I've had this conversation with people, most of them say, well, yeah, of course, I agree with that too. But the people then often have different ways that they articulate how they get that understanding. So for myself, it's a kind of gnosis. I don't really know how I get it, but I know it's there. With a lot of Christian people, it can be that it's God. You perceive it to be God. Or if you're a kind of Quaker type of Christian, you might say it's the God within me. But in a way, it doesn't really matter terribly, in my view, how we articulate how this knowledge comes, because the knowledge per se is enough in itself. Let's live our lives as beautifully and as well as possible. So those are my two answers to the question of why we should be compassionate. So now I just want to address how to be compassionate. And I want to just read you some statistics. So there are 3.1 million children who die of starvation in the world every day. Every year, rather. That's... sorry about that. That's 8,493 a day. That's 6 children every minute. During the period of this talk, over 100 children will die of starvation. And this is something that we can avoid. And then we've got the situation in Bangladesh, the Rohingya crisis. And Bangladesh, one of the world's poorest countries, is currently building a refugee camp for 800,000 people coming over the border from Burma. And according to the UNHCR, 152 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance urgently. 64 million have been forced to leave their homes. And about 3,000 people so far this year are feared to have drowned coming across the Mediterranean in search of sanctuary and mercy from us. So those are some appalling statistics. And the thing is, you see, we all know this stuff. I'm sure you've heard this before. But somehow the status quo continues. So the interesting question for me is, how come when we know people are suffering like that, do we not do anything about it? Or enough about it? And the answer I have for this is, I think, quite an enlightening one, which is that I think it's about empathy fatigue. Remember, I'm distinguishing here between empathy and compassion. So empathy is just when you see the suffering. It's not about action, it's just when you see the suffering, right? And, you know, on TV, when we turn on the TV every night, slumped back on our sofa, we see these pictures of suffering from all around the world. And they go from one to another, to another, to another. And then there's the adverts or the weather or the sport. And then we're on to the next thing, the next program. And at no point is there an invitation to act. At no point is there an invitation for our compassion from the telly. So we're stuck with this kind of empathy fatigue. And what's really interesting about this is that in the last 20 years or so, they've begun wiring people's brains up and they've got more and more accurate with finding out what's going on in people's brains. And so now they can look at someone's brain scan and identify when they're being empathic. And they've done experiments on people where they've given them pictures of people suffering and seen what lights up in the brain, and it's always in the same part of the brain. And they've tried this with loads of different people. And the subjects come out of the experimentation exhausted and upset, and they don't want to keep going on being experimented on and so on. And then a few years ago, there was a guy called Matthew Ricard, who is a French Buddhist. And he started having these tests done. And he'd been meditating for years. I think the guy spent 5 years in solitary confinement as well, voluntarily. This is a man who's well practiced in meditation. And he was doing the empathy stuff. And the lights were going on, very bright in his case, in this particular area associated with empathy, which is also a very painful area. You know, people experience, it's unpleasant. It's really unpleasant being empathic. Anyway, he was going through all this. And then suddenly, his whole head lit up. All the regions of the brain, or lots of regions of the brain, lit up. So the empathy region was still lit up, but then there was a lot of other regions coming on as well, regions associated with pleasure as well. And the experimenter was completely baffled and indeed had never seen such high readings. And she said, "What's going on? What are you thinking about?" And he said, "I couldn't bear the empathy any longer. I've started to think what I would do to help these people." And suddenly all these lights were lighting up in his head. And he said, "And it feels so much better." And so they had uncovered a really important truth here, which is that when we're stuck with empathy, we suffer. But when we combine it with action, we start to feel better. The transition from empathy to compassion is critically important. Otherwise, we get stuck with empathy. And what happens when we get stuck with empathy for long enough is that we start to avoid it, as we do with all suffering. You know, people think of all kinds of ways of distracting themselves from suffering. And so I'd just like to tell you 8 D's, which are 8 ways that people try to avoid feeling empathy, because it's just too painful. If you can't act, it's just too painful to feel the empathy for very long. So very quickly, these D's are disbelief. So we just reject the statistic and say that's not real. Someone's invented that. Disassociation, that's not my problem. Charity begins at home and it ends at home. That's nothing to do with me. Depersonalization. So doctors, rather than seeing Fred Bloggs on the ward who's got a liver complaint, refer to the liver complaint in bed 3. We depersonalize the person to remove ourselves from identifying empathically with them. Then there's disempowerment, where we say, well, it's not really our job to help people at all. That's the people in charge that should be doing that. And there have been experiments done by, you probably know, by a man called Milgram, who tested people's obedience to authority and got many of his subjects who really believed that they were hurting someone to go ahead and hurt someone, although they weren't actually, on the understanding that he was instructing them to do so. The experimenter was instructing them to do so. And what this experiment showed is that we're all far more conformist than we think we are. And we're far more prepared to hand responsibility upwards than to take it ourselves. So that's another way of avoiding taking responsibility for someone's empathy. Then there's distortion of feelings. So, for example, guilt can become anger. There was a man called Bruno Bettelheim who in the concentration camps, he was a psychologist, he was one of the prisoners, and so he started to work out what was going on in the camp, and he noticed that when people were queuing to ask the guards for a day off because they were sick, he noticed what happened. And the ones that went to the front and got down on their knees and pleaded and begged for a day off weren't given a day off. And the ones who were much more casual about it and said, could you please just give me a day off, were much more likely to get it. And he figured out that that was because of the guards' guilt. So the ones that made the guards feel guilty were less likely to get the guards' cooperation, because the guard didn't want to feel the guilt, they didn't want to be empathic, so instead they went to anger and rejected the person. And then there's another one where there was a man called Zimbardo did an experiment on prisons, and he mocked up a prison, divided people into two, half of them became prisoners, half of them became guards. It was going to be a several-month-long experiment, and they had to stop it after two days because the guards had become aggressive and were actually starting to beat up the prisoners. And the theory there was that the guards' fear had been translated into aggression. They didn't want to feel the fear. And they didn't want to see how upset the prisoners were. So again, that's another D for making us avoid empathy. And then there's devalidation, which is where we just undermine the person's story. So this happens a lot with refugees and asylum seekers. We just find ways of not believing them. And very imaginatively so in the case of the Home Office. And then there's defamation. So although asylum seekers are not allowed to work, they are taking our jobs. And there's all kinds of other ways that we defame them. We call asylum seekers terrorists. We're worried about them being terrorists, even though they are actually fleeing from terrorists. So that's another way we flip it over and make it so that we don't have to relate empathically with those people. And the final D is downright hatred. And somehow that kind of becomes the accumulation of just not being able to identify empathically over a long period of time. So those are some of the reasons why we don't become compassionate. Another one is our own resistance to our own suffering. So to the extent that we don't want to look at our own despair, our own upset, our own grief, whatever it is, to the extent that we haven't been there with ourselves, then if we're alongside someone else who's experiencing those types of feelings, the chances are subliminally or in some way we will be saying to them, I'm not giving you permission to go there, because that's the way it is with us. So that's another way that we may not become compassionate, because we've done a little remove from ourselves in this case. And the final way we're not compassionate is by not being in the present moment. And there are a million and one ways, as I'm sure you know, where we're not in the present moment. How many times do you sit at home on your sofa without the TV on, without the radio on, without any music on, without a magazine in your lap? How many times do you just sit? If you're anything like me, it's pretty rare. And if you have a partner or a friend, how often is it that you just sit with them, beside them, maybe holding their hand, looking into their eyes? How often do you do it? It's tough. Being in the present moment is tough. We've forgotten. We've forgotten how to do it. We live in an age of distraction. And as long as we're not in the present moment, we have no focus. We have no way to act. The only way we can act is in the present moment. It's the only time we can act. So intentions are all well and good, but if we don't ever come back to the present moment, we can never act. So part of why we can't be compassionate is that we find it very hard to be in the present moment. And the corollary of that is that in order to become more compassionate, we need to relearn how to get back into the present moment. And meditation is one way of doing that. Prayer may be another. But certainly finding ways to be aware of distractions as they come up and not getting hooked up on them, so that we practice the muscle, if you like, of becoming more and more in the present moment. So I'm nearly finished now, but I'm just going to say a few more things about being compassionate and how we can be. One of them, as I say, is being more in the present moment. And another one we've already covered, which is acting. Do something, however small, do it. The actual doing will rewire your brain. And they've shown this. So with the tests where they put electrodes on people, they looked at people who have had long-term meditation practices, and they've identified where the compassion centers are in the brain, and those people have bigger compassion centers. And it isn't just that the more compassionate people decide to meditate, because they've also taken Joe Bloggs, put them on a short course of meditation, just 8 weeks, and already the brain chemistry starts to change. So we can actually train ourselves to be compassionate. How extraordinary is that, in how much it liberates the power within us to change and to align ourselves with a positive evolution into the future. And then there are actually meditation practices, and I won't go into all of them, but one of them, Metta Bhavna, is about cultivating loving kindness for ourselves, for a friend, for a neutral person, for someone to whom we have aversion, and then also radiating it out further. And those practices also have been shown to change people's brain chemistry. So they do work. But I think it's really interesting that the first stage of these meditations is about self-love. And it seems to me that this is also a linchpin about how we can become more compassionate. So, and this is something that is quite hard for some people in the West. There's a story about the Dalai Lama coming over to the West when he'd not been long exiled from Tibet, and he was sort of meeting up with meditators in the West and saying, how is it here? And they were saying, well, we have a real trouble with people hating themselves so much. And there was this long silence, and he sort of said something like, what? And they said, yeah, people hate themselves a lot. And he sort of scratched his head a bit and said, no, they shouldn't be doing that. And it was like he hadn't quite... That wasn't a problem they had in Tibet, not big time anyhow. It was kind of, it didn't quite add up for him. It's a problem we have in the West, though, for sure. And I think it's got confused. I think people confuse self-love with selfishness. Whereas actually, my perception is they are opposites. How can we love other people if we don't love ourselves? We have nothing to give. Whatever we will be doing will be compensating for the gap in ourselves. If our glass is empty, we've got nothing to give. It's a bit like the thing on the aircraft, you know, when the oxygen goes, you have to breathe first yourself and then you can give it to your child. If you're dying of not enough oxygen, you can't help anyone. So it feels to me like a moral imperative that we have to take responsibility for loving ourselves and get on with it. That's the first thing, really, that we have to do. And that was another thing that hit me when I got my cancer diagnosis. Because I've had low self-esteem all my life. And it just sort of dawned on me. I've got to give this stuff up, you know. I've got to stop doing this. It is time to move on from this, really. It is time to start taking responsibility and looking after myself and caring for myself. And I don't mean there going on lots of addictions and that sort of thing. I mean soothing myself, loving myself, caring for myself. Understanding why it's difficult for me sometimes. Understanding the context of that. And also giving myself credit where I can. And having that as a practice, because no one else is going to give that to me, you know. And it to the extent that I don't look after myself, I burden other people. My wife the other day was feeling a bit low, and typical male, I go on the alert, and I think, oh God, I've got to fix this, you know. And so I ask her, what's up? Can I help? And she said, yeah, you can help. And I thought, oh, great, I can help. She's gonna give me something I can do to make her feel better. And she said, look after yourself. And that's the kind of, it's the same thing again. We need to learn to look after ourselves. And a lot of people say, but I don't know how to. And I would say to you, that's a red herring. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. The how is just a way we can go off in our minds and not do this piece of work. You do know how to look after yourselves. It's about opening up inside, and we all know how to do it. So the invitation is to start with that. I have something also to say. I'm nearly finished now. I have something also to say about us as a species, which is that we need to start self-love as a species. If we're to make this shift from ethnocentric to the next step on evolutionarily, which is anthropocentric, we have to start loving the species. How many times have you heard people saying, oh, God, people, aren't we terrible? What a mess we're in. Aren't people dreadful? There's so much wrong in the world. So much war. Look at all these people who've done their sexual abuse and all of this and mistreating women and so on and so forth. And of course, it's true. You know, we are struggling. The species as a whole has a big crack across it. But you can think of this another way, which is also that we've gone through an incredibly accelerated period of growth, our species. You know, we've come off of being connected to the land, and suddenly we're living in cities. We've come from a stage where we were like animals, just part of everything, to a point where we are actually now aware of our separateness. We're aware of our, we know about our knowing. And that's quite an isolating, frightening, and mega huge development in our evolution. So no wonder we're finding it difficult. No wonder we're suffering. There is a lot to change and there is a lot to develop. But hey, we are a wonderful species. our intelligence is unbelievably awesome. And just the fact that we are here, I hope in a minute, having a discussion about compassion, just the fact that we're thinking about compassion sets us apart as a species. So as a species, we have the capacity to do great good. And, you know, we need to recover our self-esteem about that. And I think at the moment, part of what's going wrong is just as an individual level, you know, we can feel low self-esteem because we don't really know where we're going and what motivates us, and we're not connected to our compassion a lot of the time, and that's hurtful, not knowing what your direction is. The same is happening for us as a species. So if you turn on the news, what interests people is the growth rate and the interest rates and, you know, how much money they've got and who's been committing which crimes against who and all of that. We don't hear what progress we're making as a species because we're not focused on that. We've lost our sense of direction. And yet, it is within our capacity, within one generation, to eradicate children starving. It is within our capacity to house everybody. It is within our capacity to give everybody decent health care, decent education. This is all within our capacity. We can do it in a few years. We can eradicate many of the diseases in the world within a few years. And think about our self-esteem if we did that. How would that change our self-esteem? So I think I'll end it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Warren. So much to reflect on there. So we'll just have a couple of minutes just chatting to your neighbour, and then we'll go into questions and comments. So let's hear some comments. I'll put this under your nose, if I may, so that everybody can hear what you're saying. Who'd like to share what you've been thinking or saying?
So I was just wondering about the kind of the self-love, but how you can make sure it doesn't go too far, because some people clearly will love themselves a lot and put a lot of time into themselves, which then leads to them not being able to show that love to others. And I was wondering if there was something to be said for, if we all love each other, then we shouldn't need to spend so much time loving ourselves.
I think I would like to gently challenge you that you can overdo it. I think my experience is that to the extent that I can love myself, I'm much more able to love other people. And maybe what you're thinking about is something to do with, which isn't quite self-love, which is more about a kind of indulgence of addictions and greed and other of less savoury desires, which actually I don't think is about self-love, but can sometimes be put into that category. So I don't think you can overdo it.
The difference between self-love and self-indulgence.
Yes.
We were just saying that a lot of the bigger things that we cannot do, we haven't got the power to go and feed the millions and all the rest of it. And in our small ways, we can only do small actions, and they should be, if you aim for one act of kindness at least a day, that is part of the compassionate road that we're taking.
Absolutely. And some of our best influence is local. And who knows, these little acts can sometimes ripple on. But yeah, just do what you can.
Really, I think you talked about being overwhelmed because there's so much. One of it's probably one of your D's, wasn't it?
But yes.
To do a little thing that might lead to more.
I was just wondering, thinking back to the Midstaffs disaster, where the nurses just completely failed in any compassionate relationship with many of the patients. Should we expect them to be compassionate? If I was in hospital, I want them to do the job. And I would say, if they are compassionate, that's a bonus, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's foremost in what I would expect from them. That might be slightly provocative.
Yeah, provocative's okay. Well, it's funny you should say that, because there was quite an interesting account I was reading when I was looking at the distinction between empathy and compassion. There was a nurse who was talking about her experience in hospital of working with terminally ill patients. And she confided to the researcher that her professionalism meant that she shouldn't really reach out to people. She shouldn't really touch the patients and do anything other than the kind of demands that the task in hand required her to do. And she said that she'd broken the rules, and that she found herself putting out an arm to comfort people and so on. And she confessed to the researcher that the process of doing that actually made her feel better. And she felt a bit embarrassed about the fact that she was feeling better. Here was this person who was clearly suffering, and yet somehow by reaching out, she was feeling better herself. And of course, that's the transition from empathy over into compassion. And what the researcher commented on this was that apparently, according to a survey they did in America, 60% of the medical staff in America suffer burnout at least once in their careers, where they really can't go on because it's just too much. Being around people's empathy and not being able to reach out is painfully difficult to sustain. So actually, in terms of, you know, having a staff that is functional, allowing them to reach out to patients and not be overly professional may actually help them to be more efficient and to sustain what they're doing.
Juan and me also bonded a bit when we found we had a similar but different medical condition. I still remember very powerfully when I was going through what I shall describe euphemistically as a procedure, you know, hospital procedures. And there was a very, very efficient male doctor there who was doing everything precisely according to the book. But it hurt at times. And there was a nurse there standing, attending, saw me wince, and instinctively, and she probably shouldn't have done this, reached out and held my hand. And I felt such a deep wave of something go across my body at that moment. It wasn't planned. She just did it instinctively, and it's probably despite herself. And it just, warmth went through my whole body. I just felt, somebody cares that I'm suffering here. I mean, it mattered that the doctor was doing his job right, and that was probably, but this, it just made such a difference to me. So I hope it's both and, but I suppose in the end of the day, I want to stay alive. So get that bit right.
Just to say that Juan doesn't give himself credit for an act of compassion that I happen to know about. Over many, many years, he has supported a Kenyan who came to this country and was not allowed to work and had to be just a volunteer. And he was well established here in Oxford thanks to refugee support and did voluntary jobs. And then he was taken without any warning and sent down to Devon, where he didn't know anybody, and his young son as well. But Juan has supported him all these years and written to the Home Office and stated his case, and he now does have, after, what is it, 12 years, 10 years? 14 years, Thomas Kamau now has permission to work, and that's the sort of job that he has been doing. And this man is now able to earn a living, is able to run a car, is working as a occupational therapist, physiotherapist. Yeah, I'm very glad to say.
You're very kind, but there's lots of people was involved in that, including you.
We'd better draw to a close because we do bill this as finishing at 8. But just a last question before I go and get something to round off with. If someone thinks they might be able to help with sanctuary hosting, or they know somebody who might, what's the first thing that they should do? Any practical things to say?
There's a sign-up sheet at the back, and there's three ways you can help. First way is to become a host, and we realise most people can't do that for all kinds of different reasons. There's no shame in that, but yeah, if you want to become a host, then there's a way to apply for that. The second way is to be a volunteer, and we have people who are assessing potential guests, assessing potential hosts. Guests are sanctuary seekers, supporting guests with hosts, and supporting hosts with guests, so that we train up volunteers basically to run the scheme. So if you want to be a volunteer, that's the second way. And the third way is we're trying to get the scheme to be self-financing so that we're not reliant on public funding or making lots of grant applications, which kind of distracting. So we've asked people to give a standing order, and we think that if 250 people give between 3 and 5 cups of coffee a month, that's £10 to £20 a month, that we will be entirely self-financed by the community. And we're about a third of the way to achieving that. Lots of people have been doing it. So if you would be willing to do that, there's a sign-up form there.
And so, Wyan, that's magnificent, really. So much you've given us to think on and to reflect on, and love that thing. Action will give us the energy back if we get compassion fatigue. So thank you, Wyan. Can we thank you for coming tonight.